Harvard professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt have been studying how authoritarianism rises and democracies fail around the world for years. But after the 2016 presidential election, they turned their attention to the health of America's democracy. And they've put their findings in their new book. It's called How Democracies Die. And their greatest concern is with the responsibility established political parties hold in protecting democratic norms. Daniel Ziblatt began by explaining a kind of litmus test they include in their book. How would you measure authoritarianism in American government today?
If a politician goes after the media, if they endorse violence, if they question the legitimacy of elections, if they threaten their rivals, to lock up their rivals or accuse their rivals of their political rivals of not being loyal to the country, these are clear hallmarks of an authoritarian. In addition to all of the offensive things he's said, you know, at a very basic, minimal level, if a politician does any of those four things that I just listed, we believe that the historical record suggests that establishment politicians must distance themselves from this kind of figure.
When Paul Ryan says, for example, when President Trump maligned a member of the federal judiciary because of his ancestry, and when Paul Ryan says, well, that's textbook racism, but I'm not going to do anything about it, what does that mean for our democracy?
It means that Republicans were abdicating their responsibility, their historic responsibility to defend democracy. Now, establishment Republicans were in a tough place. He won the primary. They didn't have any institutional tools to stop him from winning the primary. So this was not an easy position for someone like Paul Ryan to be in.
And it's remarkable how you point out that before sort of Cold War and earlier, democracies fell in spectacular fashion, right? Military coup, for example. But that it's entirely different after the Cold War. What's that key difference?
The difference is it's far more likely today that democracy dies at the hands of elected leaders, often freely elected ones, who have disarmed democracy after being freely elected, who've used the tools and the institutions of democracy, paradoxically, to kill it or to wound it.
And you give the example, and maybe it's worth walking through it a little bit, of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Sure. Hugo Chavez was freely elected. Hugo Chavez governed in a fairly democratic manner in his initial years in office. But eventually, the Chavez government slowly but surely began to go after the press, to punish independent media, to close down independent media, pack the courts, eventually begin to arrest opponents, exile opponents, and establish what is now a pretty authoritarian regime.
Mm. So I want to ask you, because this idea, in your words, that democratic backsliding can begin at the ballot box is incredibly important for us to understand because, in a sense, you know, there's that old saying that in a democracy, you get the leadership that you deserve. I mean, we were looking back at a January 2016 article from Matthew McWilliams, who was doing research through UMass Amherst, and he did polling across the country, and he wrote in January of 2016 that I have found a single statistically significant variable that predicts whether a voter supports Trump. It's not race, income, or education levels. It's desire for authoritarian leadership.
There is pretty good evidence that Americans have long had an authoritarian streak, whether it's Father Coughlin, whether it's Henry Ford,
George
who flirted
Wallace,
with the presidency,
right.
George Wallace. We argue that it's ultimately the role of party leaders to make sure that demagogues don't get the nomination.
Okay, so then let's look to our own history then. In those other cases, exactly what did the parties do to buttress the democracy in those cases?
So until 1972, party leaders often picked candidates in smoke-filled rooms, which doesn't have a good reputation. Somebody like Henry Ford considered running for president, but it became very clear there was actually a survey done in the 1920s of party leaders, and he was very unpopular with Democratic Party leaders, whereas voters, he was very popular with voters. And so until the 1970s, we had a system in which party leaders picked candidates, and they, you know, and with, for all the problems, we're not arguing that we should go back to the system.
I'm saying like the smoke-filled room doesn't,
right.
It sounds a step backward,
yes,
for democracy.
Yes, absolutely, right. So this in a way, but there's a lesson in that, which is that there's a way in which our current system is, you know, it's clearly an improvement on the old system, but it's a double-edged system. I mean, it opens the door for demagogues, the post-1972 election system.
I mean, to that end, I just want to ask you about the like if we could go as deep as we possibly could, even deeper than the level of hyper-partisanship about what's driving what seems like a slow erosion of American democracy. I mean, is it things like rampant inequality, racism, the, I don't know, the weakening of public education? Those things put together lead to this outcome of a weakening of democracy.
I think one of the factors, which is we touch on the, in the book but don't develop much in the book, is almost unprecedented inequality. We now have reached levels of income inequality higher than any time since before the Depression, and by some measures, close to highest levels of income inequality ever. Now, the primary focus, though, of the book is a little bit different. We think that race and culture ultimately are driving this polarization. Three things have happened since the 1960s to contribute to this. First of all, the civil rights movement and the success of the civil rights movement led to a massive migration of Southern whites from the Democratic to the Republican Party. Secondly, large-scale immigration transformed the demographics of this country, and the vast majority of immigrants ended up in the Democratic Party. And third, since Reagan, we have a massive migration of evangelicals, which used to be in both parties, equally split between both parties, are now overwhelmingly Republican. So whereas in the 1950s and the 1960s, even the early 70s, both parties were demographically very similar. They were basically both white Christian parties through the 1960s. Now we have two parties that are demographically very different. The Democrats are a party of basically urban educated whites or urban secular whites and a diversity of ethnic minorities. And the Republicans have become essentially a white Christian party.
So let me just jump in here. Are you saying that one of the reasons why our democracy may be imperiled is racism?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. So white Christians are not just any group, right? White Christians were a dominant electoral majority not long ago.
They were the nexus of power, exactly.
So our society has transformed over 50 years, and many white Christians, not all Republican voters, but many Republican voters feel like the country that they grew up with is being taken away from them.
Understood. And we've heard this before, but what I guess what I'm saying is, what does it say about the inherent strengths or weaknesses of the American democratic experiment that if in this evolution, this transformation, we're talking about how American democracy might die?
Here's what we think it says. The democratic norms that sustained us in the 20th century in many, many positive ways, in which the two parties accepted each other as legitimate and basically played nice, that was founded on racial exclusion. Those norms were created and sustained in an overwhelmingly white Christian society. What we haven't done yet is adapt to a diverse society based on racial equality.
So to get us back to the question of parties and their role in all of this, this leaves me feeling very depressed. Because it's the very same party leadership, specifically I'm going to say on the Republican side, that I don't see making any moves, having any drive or any meaningful desire to change this trajectory. You're shaking your head. Maybe am I being too pessimistic here?
So there's things for politicians and for parties to do on both sides. So, I mean, one of the things that we think is that the Democratic – well, first of all, the Republican Party needs to diversify.
Give me a little bit of hope, because you talk about how a sort of a party reckoning is possible, and you look to the former West Germany.
Yeah.
West Germany as an example. Yeah. Can you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, so one of the key – shapers of German political life through the 19th and 20th century was a dysfunctional right in Germany. And it was only after World War II that the German center right was refounded on a democratic basis. And so that's a model, but it's not a very exciting model at some level, because what was required was the devastation and tragedy of World War for the right to finally understand in Germany that it needed to be refounded on a democratic basis.
You close your book by saying that, you quote Daniel Ellen, also from Harvard, the remarkable Daniel Ellen, that basically the challenge, a great American challenge, is that we as a nation are trying to attempt something that has never been attempted before in humanity, right? In her words, it says, build a genuine multi-ethnic democracy where political, social, and economic equality are all achieved. Do you still believe that that is indeed actually possible in the United States?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, this requires creative political leadership. It requires active citizenry. And these are the things, you know, that we hope can happen. And one of the purposes of the book is, again, to look beyond just Donald Trump and to kind of put the full scale of the challenge in front of us.
Yeah. Look, if any democracy in the world is going to do it, it's ours. We have the oldest, most successful constitution in the world. We have very robust democratic institutions. We are a society that has successfully assimilated ethnic minorities in the past. So, yeah, if there's a country in the world that's capable of doing it, it's ours.
Well, the new book is How Democracies Die. It's by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Professors, thank you so very much for coming in. It's a remarkable book, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.